I'm Darlene Grega, and I serve in campus ministry at Duke University. And while at Holden, I'm here working with the teen program. And one of my interests in working with the teen program was to discuss various issues. And I had, in my time of sharing with Larry, I mentioned that I wanted to talk with the teenagers about registration in the draft, and then perhaps in another evening bring their parents in so they could be in dialogue with one another. And Larry said, that's great. Perhaps the entire village would like to hold a forum on registration in the draft. It's particularly timely. As a person serving in campus ministry, particularly in Lutheran campus ministry, I'm aware that there are various positions that we hold as Christians concerning peace, war, and conscience. I'm also aware, as a personal, in a pastoral position, although I do have my own feelings about this issue, I have to respect the integrity and feelings of students who come down on various sides of the issues. I deal with people who are honestly searching for a responsible, looking for a responsible place to stand in these perplexing issues that are affecting their lives. As I look around the room, there are several age groups present this evening. Although the draft, the registration issue, which came to a head this only a week and a half ago, affects a particular segment at this time, I would venture to say that it in fact affects the grandparents that I see sitting over here because of their grandchildren, parents, and those of you who are even younger yourself, and then of course in the future your children. How many of you are in fact 19 or 20 years of age? Yeah, I'm not. 18 to 26. About a fourth of the people here. And those of you that are under will most probably be facing the question of registration in the next few years. This evening I'd like to, for those of you who've been in the village a while, don't get the privilege of seeing a newspaper any too often or hearing the radio and are possibly not aware of the most recent updates. On June 12th, the Senate passed the appropriations for reinstating the selective service system and registration. In the next 5 weeks, that is 5 weeks from June 12th, young men aged 19 and 20, or those born in 1960 or 61, will be required to register at their local post office.
What was the bullet on it?
That I am not sure, but from what I understand, in the House, if you remember last September 12th, I think it was, the House of Congress and the House of Representatives and Senate overwhelmingly defeated that. When it came up again in June, that it was just the reverse. It was pretty strong in support of registration.
House was fairly close in April, 218, 181, something like that. I've heard the Senate was overwhelming.
Yeah.
A very strong vote in favor, stronger than the House of Representatives.
It was an all-night session, the first all-night session in 3 years. The first group of youth to register, of course, will be the 19 and 20-year-olds. It'll be spread over 2 weeks, so 5 weeks from June 12th is about the third week in July. So those of you who are even here at Holden might consider finding out a little bit more about that, because supposedly you'll be required to register.
Could you clarify what you mean by 19 and 20? Does that include the 20-year-old olders who were born in 59 that haven't turned 21 yet?
No, only people born in 1960 and 1961. That is how I understand it. Is there anyone else who understands that differently? I want to say that I will be able to clarify all your questions. There are people in the audience here this evening who are much more knowledgeable about this issue than I am, and I hope that they will speak up. There will be no draft cards. No chance of burning your draft card this time around. When you register, you will register at the post office, give them your name, address, social security number. Anytime you move, which includes, I understand, when you move to and from your home to go to college, you will need to notify the people in the selective service system. There will be no physical examination at the time of registration. They are separating registration from anything like that. They are separating registration from also from signing up as a conscientious objector. When you register, everybody registers in the same way. You will sign the same card. They will not give you the option at the time of registration of registering as a conscientious objector, for those of you who want to know about that. They say that the purpose of registration is to save as many as 90 to 100 days in the event of military mobilization. That's highly debatable if you would read some of the papers that are coming out, even from the defense, the Department of Defense. Registration will cost approximately $13.4
billion.
Million dollars, excuse me. Thank you. On top of the Selective Service budget, which is already $7.8 million for this year. Even if you have an obvious physical disability, you will need to register. The only people who will be exempt from registration are active members of the armed forces. Whether or not that includes reserves is not clear. And I have not heard anything about that, so if you're in the reserves, you'll need to find out about that. The penalty for those of you who fail to, those of us who fail to register, those of you at the present time, $10,000 and or 5 years in prison. Approximately 2 million people, 2 million men will be registering. If 2% of those people fail to register, there will be approximately 80,000 felons. Whether or not our penal system can accommodate that is another question people have raised. The president cannot start up the draft again on his own. It requires the express approval of Congress. There, you might ask what grounds, exemptions, or deferments might be granted. The acceptable grounds will probably be physical or mental disabilities, hardship situations, or conscientious objection. We'll probably talk a little bit more about conscientious objection later if you ask the question. Who will be the first to go if the draft is reinstated? Those in their 20th year, that is in their 20th year when draft is reinstated, not in their 20th year this year, unless the draft is reinstated this year. And then there'll be a lottery as to what day of the year you were born and how soon you will be called up for the draft. 2 million before, that's 2 million 19-year-olds and 2 million 20-year-olds, making for 4 million young men who will be required to register in the upcoming weeks. Most of you, as I look around the audience, maybe not most of you, but many of you perhaps do not even remember the last time that we had a draft. The draft officially ended in this country on December 31st, 1972. The last time when registration ended, it ended in March of 1975. So many of you, especially if we look at the 19 and 20-year-olds, 1972 was 8 years ago. They were 11 and 12. How many 11 and 12-year-olds even recall much talk about draft, Vietnam, registration, the entire issue? I think it's appropriate for us at Holden Village as Christian people to look at the question of peace, war, and conscience, specifically as it relates to registration and the draft, because registration has been reinstated and in the next 5 weeks you will be required as 19 and 20-year-old males to register. I will pose several questions to begin our discussion this evening. There are no correct answers to the questions. The only answers are those answers which are true for you. I'd like to begin by asking you to think about these questions in terms of developing your own value system or clarifying your own value system as to how you feel about registration, draft, and war. Some people like to separate all three issues. I believe that they're intimately connected. I believe that registration cannot be thought of without draft because it inevitably can and most probably will lead to that. It has in the past in the United States, and I personally do not see that anything else would happen at this time. Some of the questions that you might ask yourself. Does the government have a right to do this to me, this being require you to register or, in effect, later possibly to be drafted? What, if anything, do I owe the government in those critical areas in return for the benefit it affords me in all other areas? Is what the government says I owe it in this critical area consistent with my understanding or conviction regarding the proper exercise of governmental power? Is violence ever an effective or appropriate solution to conflict? If so, under what conditions and in what circumstances? What do I believe about the right of the government to require its citizens to engage in combat where it might be necessary for a person to harm or kill another human being? What is the nature of my obligation to obey the government? What do I think about the rightness or wrongness of my country's involvement in and relationship to other nations of the world? What about its military posture in terms of its national self-interest and the interests of other nations? Those are just a few questions. On the board behind me, I realize that although not everyone in this room comes out of the Lutheran tradition, for the most part, the people we are addressing in the room are Lutherans. And therefore, we have chosen to set up three positions, the three Christian war peace traditions on the board. The first being on the left-hand side, the just war ethic. Inside the just war ethic, we have the positions, the possible positions, if you profess the just war ethic as Lutherans traditionally do, you have the position of being a selective conscientious objector or a selective conscientious participator. Do you know what those two positions are? Does anybody want to tell us what a selective conscientious objector is? Linda?
It's someone who objects to the particular war.
Okay. She said it's the person who objects to a particular war. That is, as opposed to a conscientious objector who would oppose all forms of war. Traditionally, Lutherans would be selective conscientious objectors. That means that they would first judge the war. The criteria for just war are long. There's a long list. I'll mention them. Possibly you can begin to think about them as Lutherans who are contemplating stances of selective conscientious objection. The first, in terms of just war, the first consideration is when you're contemplating warfare, you ask, does the war have a just cause? That is, will it protect the is it to protect the innocent or to restore basic rights wrongfully denied? Is it a truly last resort? Methods short of violence have been exhausted. That's a difficult one. Have all methods short of violence been tested, been exhausted? Will it be entered through the nation's properly constituted procedure for declaring and waging war? That was a big objection in the Vietnam conflict. Does it have reasonable prospect of success? That is, can the goals of warfare likely be attained without squandering the lives and goods of the people? And then, criteria during the conduct of warfare. Does the conduct show due proportion between means used and ends sought, avoiding wanton and unnecessary destruction? Does the conduct safeguard non-combatants, using force only to restrain and doing no harm to those who can inflict no harm, that is, civilians or prisoners? And does the government promise mercy to a defeated enemy, including assistance with rebuilding what has been destroyed? All those points, all those criteria, should be considered in the case of the selective conscientious objector or the selective conscientious participator. Does anybody know what a selective conscientious participator is?
Some kind of alternative service.
Is that right?
It's just a shift in the burden of proof.
Right.
For a selective conscientious objector, you rather much assume that the state is engaging in justified war, but this particular war may be an exception to that. So, for example, the United States, we assume that there was justified participation in the First World War against Nazism, the Korean War, but a lot of people said, no, in Vietnam, I object to participation. The stance is one where which normally you will accept participation. Selective conscientious participation, in contrast with objection, is a person who starts with the assumption that there isn't a justifiable war. You will not participate. But one war might come along, which is an exception to that. So you may have been pacifist. Or you may have come out of the just war ethic and said participation in the First World War was not proper, but you recognized in Hitler a justified opposition. So it's a shift in the burden of proof.
Okay.
The selective conscientious participator starts more over closer to the pacifist position.
Selective conscientious objection is not recognized by selective service as a state in which you would be exempt from participation in combat. It is not. To the middle, which is an extreme, the pacifist ethic.
Are you through with the first one?
No, we won't talk about it. That was just being presented. Mark?
I have a question, and that is, how can people such as we who do not have access to accurate information, who cannot depend on the media to report events, make a decision about participation or objection? Where are we to get our facts on foreign policy, for instance, when sometimes it seems like the State Department and the President can't get the facts? What is our basis to be for that?
We don't have a choice. I'm going to be here throughout that deadline, and I've got to make up my mind right now. So this is the only chance that I have is up here.
You say you don't. You have to make up your mind right now. You really don't. You mean you do, but you don't. Because in order to register, you can just register. You can begin to create a file for yourself as a conscientious objector, if that would be the route that you would choose. Everyone has to file whether or not they choose to be a CO or a participator, unless they are going to go the route of noncompliance. As Lutherans, if we hold to the just war ethic, I believe, if I'm decoding this properly, we cannot register, because we don't know if what we're going to participate in is going to be a just war or not. So in a sense, if we follow that, we'd have to register. Does that sound?
It certainly is correct for selective conscientious objection.
Mm-hmm.
It would not necessarily be the case for selective conscientious participation, because there you start closer to the pacifist end of the spectrum. You assume that participation in the war is wrong. There are not those folks.
Well, what does it mean to participate? I was thinking about, say there was a missile coming at us, would participating be shooting down that missile? Not offensive at all, just saving our country. So that, I would not mind doing that, but I would mind killing somebody. So what do they count that as? It's not killing, it's just saving.
It doesn't fit into me, John.
Participation normally means, are you going to cooperate and be part of the military troops or forces of the country or not? Within that, there will be some options. Selective conscientious objectors could object to any participation in the military and ask for alternative service, or non-combatant role within the military in uniform and be a medic. In other words, there are some other choices down the line, but I think primarily what we're talking about now is participation, meaning accept the authority of the government and selective service over your life and comply with what they ask you to do. That's probably the best way to talk about participation right now. But there are some other further options and choices. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
As I understand it, once you're in the military system, you surrender certain civil liberties in terms of military law and tried within a military tribunal. And
I had friends who, when they were drafted, went in as selective conscientious objectors and went in as medics and were told that they would be serving as medics. And once they got there, they were trained for combat, and they were very much opposed to that. And they left. And that sort of thing happened during Vietnam. John?
Let me just make one more thing before we move on. We've been talking, you probably are right, that the majority of people here are Lutheran. Let me just make one more clarification. The just war ethic is the ethic historically for almost all Christians.
Except
the Mennonite, Brethren, Quaker, and the Peace churches are a significant portion of the Christian church. But it's not just Lutherans who are just war. Roman Catholicism historically, most major Protestant groups in the United States, Methodist, Presbyterian, Congregational, in other words, that is by far the majority view historically for Christians.
And also within the mainline churches that fall under the just war ethic, there are individual persons, they are even collectives of people who would fall in the pacifist, the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, a variety of, you know, Presbyterian, Episcopal, Roman Catholic groups. Barb?
I was just going to say, the only people that I've read on the just war theory are like Luther and Augustine and nobody more recently than that, but I have the impression that neither of them would let an individual person decide on a war, whether it was just or not, and object that way. They would say more, I think both of them, that we should bow to the authorities in that and let the people in the know sort of decide. I mean, I think that's the reason that Lutherans have been so comfortable going along with all the wars that the government thinks are just, is because Luther told people so much to not try and decide on a war themselves, but leave it up to people that knew better. That's just, what do you have a reaction to that, John?
Are you asking me? I couldn't hear that.
Yeah, well,
I think you're probably fairly accurate. I'm not sure that historically the justifiable war criteria were not meant to be a matter of individual conscience, but historically Lutherans have tended to be where you are, primarily on the basis of one proof passage, Romans 13, be subject to the powers that be, for they are ordained of God. That you can listen to some tapes on the fact that that's not as straightforward as Lutherans have been told or thought for a long period of time, but nevertheless, that has been the primary proof passage to go along with what the government says. Yeah, at least heavily.
Linda, I have a question, and I'm not sure we can have a just war now with the nuclear weapons that we have, and I think during World War I and the beginning of World War II that would hold the just war ethic. But now I don't see any way that we can have a just war.
Yeah, that, excuse me for interrupting. If nuclear weapons are employed, or other weapons of absolutely massive destruction, so that you are not taking account of the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, so that, for example, elderly women or men and children are killed along with efforts to wipe out the combatants, then you violated the just war. And on these criteria, you would say, I cannot participate, either as an objector or participant. The just war ethic came about at a time when the wars that were fought were wars that we now call limited wars. If you're employing weapons of absolutely massive destruction, you've wiped out the possibility of just war by such criteria as these. However, it is also worth saying, as people who write about these things point out, that even when we have had nuclear weapons at our disposal, a number of the participation in combat has been participation in those limited wars. Because you have nuclear weapons does not mean that those weapons are going to be used. So that these same criteria are used for situations of rebellion, revolution, other cases of where the conflict is still within the kind of boundaries that these criteria were formulated for.
But can we suppose that those boundaries will not be, you know, superseded in this next confrontation, whatever it may be?
That's the reason a lot of people who were in the just war tradition have switched over to the pacifist tradition. There's a whole group of people called nuclear pacifists who used to be in the just war tradition, and with the coming of nuclear weapons, have switched to the pacifist tradition. That's what they call it.
Right. Back to the board. The middle people listed in the middle, under the pacifist ethic, as John enumerated before, the Mennonites, Brethren, Quakers, and other peace churches, those who would and have in the past historically been granted conscientious objective status on the basis of their religious beliefs. And then thirdly, the crusade ethic. And whether or not, I don't think that has been employed since the crusades. I would hope it hasn't.
It has in practice, but not as a thought-out position.
Okay.
Yeah, which is unqualified obedience. And whenever the goal is justified with no restriction whatsoever on the means of prosecuting the war. Whatever means are necessary for success are justified by a justified goal.
Okay, you've really all sat back and listened to what has happened in the past few weeks. You've heard a bit of an explanation of the traditional Christian warfare traditions. You've heard Larry and John talk a little bit more about the theology behind the Lutheran traditions. Why don't we just open it up to some questions and discussion and just bounce back and forth.
Who decides whether it's the best war? Is it the individual?
That's a good question.
If it's not the individual, then it means nothing, because the government isn't going to say, we are now entering an unjust war.
I'm sorry, I don't know the man's name there.
Sherman. I haven't read Luther on this, for a couple of what Barb said. There are some who would say Luther did make the statement that it's the government that decides whether the war is just or not. But his conception of the government the day he left was the princes. And it wasn't the masses who were the government, it was the ruling elite, the feudal system. But in a democratic society, we hold that it's the people who are the government. And therefore, some people would say that individuals, therefore, have a right to make that determination under our system of government, which is no longer feudal, but the government is the people, so that's the decision should be done.
And as I read the Lacusa document on war, peace, and conscience, that is what I hear them saying too, that they will stand behind individual Lutherans who choose, you know, to to hold a pacifist tradition. Larry?
Well, just to reply to your concern that the ethic is set up for the deliberation of Christians about their participation. This is not governments deciding what is a just war, although if you read the international laws on war and so on, very much something like just war criteria are used. That is, have all legal means been pursued? Have you pursued all the diplomatic channels? Have you tried all nonviolent means before violence is even considered? So those are used, but at governmental level. But this is for the consideration of Christians about their participation. Traditionally, it has, I think, I mean, in the West, it has focused on the individual Christian, but it is, in its origin, a conception for the Christian community in its deliberation. Now, individuals are, of course, the ones who finally must say yes or no to that, but it isn't meant to be for a solitary person on his or her own. It's for the community.
Linda? I just got a letter from my congressman this week, and he said that the registration for the draft would say 7 to 13 days. And then I had one other comment. And this is a question that I've been asking myself since second grade. And maybe some of you can come up with some answers for me. The fifth commandment says, thou shalt not kill. So I'm wondering, why does a war make killing legal?
Without supporting the answer to give you some idea, and without deciding whether or not we could have done the good, assuming that we could have headed off things in Vietnam, perhaps several of the millions, and we're talking about American deaths, 50,000. We're talking about Cambodian deaths, millions, that were just annihilated. When our troops withdrew, they went to Vietnam, and then they went to Cambodia. The whole Southeast Asia situation, I think that is the kind of answer you will get. No killing is good, but maybe it's better to kill 100,000 than several million.
I just would like more thought from people in the room, since I understand that's a Christian position, which is unqualified. Thou shalt not kill. It's one of the least ambiguous statements in the Bible. And yet, I would like to hear how anybody can take a Christian position other than that. Doesn't speak for governments, it speaks for individuals.
In a sense, are we not begging the question, you know, the comment was made over here that we're not a feudal system. Yet in Vietnam, we had King Richard and King Lyndon who declared an undeclared war, and 50,000 people were killed and millions others were destroyed. And the choice was not left up to our society or to the mass of the public to determine whether it was a just war. It was a war.
That was not an undeclared war. Congress voted funds for that war. Congress supported that war with funds. If you look at the Constitution closely, it says Congress will declare wars. It does not say how Congress will declare wars. It says Congress will declare wars. Congress unequivocally supported that war by supplying arms and equipment and funds for that war.
But we were told all the way through that war that it was a police action.
That makes no difference. It was a war supported by the representatives of the people. If the people did not want those representatives supporting the war, they could have voted for the people.
But the point is, was there ever debate as to whether it was a just war? There was never a debate. And it never would be a debate as to whether there would be a just war. We assume, as a population, because of our democratic society, which in reality is feudal, that the leaders will make the decision. And there's no way that we can say, hey, time out, let's have an election, and then let's decide whether it's a just war.
Okay, but then you must apply that to everything. Do we want to have all the people vote on every law that comes down before? Should we all vote whether it's legal to have 55 mile an hour speed limit? Should we decide whether it's legal to have allow only 18 people a day go up to Heart Lake? Shall we all vote to have 24 people go up to Holden Lake or whatever it is?
Your point, though, is weak in the sense of saying comparing a 55 mile an hour limit with killing 50,000 people.
Because we are a a people governed. We have chosen a system of representation. There's no other way that you can get 212 million people to vote on a single issue to be able to function in any type of organized system without anarchy. If you're going to vote on one issue, that the war might be a very important issue to you, and the number of people that go up to Heart Lake and Holden Lake might be a very important issue to other people, and they would want the people of this whole country to vote on it. You can't make exceptions to limit it to certain fields and to certain issues. We have chosen to have a democratic system where we elect representatives, presidents, and senators to voice our opinions. If they do not voice the opinions we want, you have the option to vote against them.
Both the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit and the option or lack of option to participate in war depends on the level to which you will obey the civil authorities. And that's one of the questions we have to continue to ask ourselves. At what level can I continue to support the civil authorities? Barb?
Well, I was just going to ask, you said it, made a comment that at this point in the U.S., nobody who holds to the just war theory at all can register as a conscientious objector, right? Because they don't recognize any kind of selective conscientious objection. So you either have to oppose always the use of any kind of force in resolving any conflict, or else you cannot register any time as a CO legally, right?
That's how I see it.
Wait a minute. Linda, this is just an answer that you can register any time to become a conscientious objector. All you have to do is write to the CCCO, which is...
Right. Oh, I see. Yeah, I agree. But you couldn't say, for example, that some wars are right and some wars are wrong, and this particular war is going to be wrong, therefore I'm a conscientious objector.
It's a little curious, but that's correct. I say it's a little curious for the reason that John mentioned. This has been the mainline tradition of Roman Catholic, Calvinist, Lutheran,
and yet we're not allowed to hold to it in the United States.
We have no legal status for people who hold to that tradition.
Are there questions in the balcony, John?
I think there have been some attempts to have selective service include the possibility of selective conscientious objection, but I don't think they have ever been successful.
There have been court cases.
Okay, and I think the wording now is opposed to war in all forms. That's really what you say if you are going to be a conscientious.
There are a list of questions. If you want them, I can read them off to you. If you want them later, I have the list of questions you would be required to fill out by the Selective Service as a conscientious objector.
Would you read?
There's a whole list of them. While I'm finding them amongst this list of paper, speaking of court cases, the American Civil Liberties Union is already going to court to try to stop registration because it discriminates against men and women, because women will not be registered at this present time.
Darlene, I just want to say, too, in the bookstore, for those that are 19 and 20 or are thinking about how they're going to register or what they're going to do, there are a lot of helps that the Lutheran Church has put out to help people make this decision.
There's also one, if you're going to read one book, there's one book that I would highly recommend, and that's called Religion and Violence by Robert McAfee Brown. I really respect his position because he hasn't always been a pacifist. He hasn't always just participated. He's fluctuated between the just war ethic and pacifism, and he's really struggled because of his participation in liberation theology. He cannot say that people involved in third and fourth world countries cannot, you know, just up and revolt to gain their freedom. He's also, you know, sided with pacifists, and I think that he's really struggled with that, and I appreciated what he's written. John?
Speak while you're looking for that. I'd like to speak to one of the first things said and then to the question about thou shalt not kill. I think the primary, my primary motivation for forums like this is for the young people who are facing that choice. And all I can respond is, I don't know of any tougher thing that you're going to face. That it is hard to get the facts, And it seems to me one of the things we ought to help one another do is to at least say where some truth is being spoken or call into question things when we think the media is not accurate, and that your Christian community ought to help you do that. And I think the Lutheran Church, in some of its things recently, is at least trying to do that. Secondly, you have a tradition, justifiable war criteria, and they are very outmoded. I mean, they were at a time of hand-to-hand combat when you could see if the other person had a uniform, then you knew you could fight. If they didn't, you knew you weren't supposed to fight. In other words, the church does not have nearly as much in the way of helping you make that decision as I wish we had. And I'm going to speak, I'm not necessarily speaking my own view on this, but I'd like to speak to the business of thou shalt not kill. The answers typically given are, first of all, there's some question, and if we have a Hebrew scholar, that would be better than my comment, some question as to whether that really means thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not commit murder. I think that is a debate over the text. That's one place where usually the argument comes. Secondly, Lutherans would answer that historically just about the way Dietrich Bonhoeffer did the other night at the Vespers. Dietrich Bonhoeffer considered himself a pacifist, considered his participation in the plot to kill Hitler as sin. He said, I am breaking a commandment. Then he justified his selective conscientious participation with the little story about the driver of the coach who had gone mad. And at that point, you did more than help the victims. You tried to get the driver out of the driver's seat. But he called it sin the whole time. And it seems to me that sometimes, maybe that's all the Lutheran Church has said. We have two options. They are both sinful. We acknowledge it. We do not try to have God justify and bless this war. We are participating in sin. We confess it. The alternative not to participate is worse sin, and so we do it, and all we can do is say we're guilty as we do it. Those are both kind of possible historic answers to a question I really think is a key.
I have the questions, and it's a long list of questions. First of all, you have to be opposed to war in any form. Objection must be based on moral, ethical beliefs or beliefs commonly accepted as religious. Your belief must influence your life as belief in God influences the life of one who is traditionally religious. In order to qualify as a conscientious objector, your conscience must be spurred by deeply held moral, ethical, or religious beliefs, which would give you no peace if you allowed yourself to become a combatant member of armed forces. Then you'd have to describe the beliefs, which are the basis for your classification as a CO. Will your beliefs allow you to serve where use of weapons is not required? If not, why not? Explain how you acquired the beliefs which are the basis of your claim, through family, books, religion, etc. Explain what most clearly shows that your beliefs are deeply held. How can you illustrate them in past or present life? Do your beliefs affect the way you live? Explain the type of work you will do to earn a living. What types of activity do you participate in non-work hours? Describe incidents of your life that show you believe as you do. The basis then, after you've written up all answered all those questions, the basis for your decision is the judgment of the local draft board. And draft boards are consistent. If you live in Minnesota or Washington or Oregon, you have a much better chance than those of us who live in North Carolina, Georgia, or Alabama. Bob.
Well, it seems that those who are less educated and couldn't write as good of an essay for why they believe this and that and couldn't present their thoughts very well would be very discriminated against.
Mm-hmm. It's very true.
True.
That's one reason the president has said that he would like to consider not having various deferments in the next, if we do go to state of declaration where we'd have to draft people. Because in the past, the people who were inducted into the Army were those people who could not get around registration in the draft, who did not know the loopholes. I work at Duke University where
most of the students are upper middle class, upper class people. They can afford lawyers to get around loopholes. Duke University can afford draft counselors. How many people working in a mill in Burlington, North Carolina, who are 19 and 20 years old, can afford the service of a lawyer, who even know that there are draft counselors available? 40% of the all-volunteer force right now, minorities, people who have graduated from high school.
In some of the interviews that occurred up when I was doing some draft counseling up in the University of Montana, when they'd go before draft boards, if they were asked, you know, do you hunt and do you use a weapon when you hunt, if they responded positively, they would be, you know, denied a SEAL status. Because you don't oppose the use of guns to kill a deer, why not a human being?
More questions, more feelings. How are you feeling about registration being introduced in the next few weeks?
What was the first statement you said at the beginning of the paper? You have to be opposed to war in any form.
Must be opposed to, right.
Well, what would that mean? I mean, I can acknowledge that a war exists and I'd like to help.
Any form.
I'd like to help it stop any.
That's separating the just war
from
the best.
Is what you were doing before, again, I think. Like Larry.
I mean, did you, maybe I missed this, is the time set for registration? I mean, what kind of time frame must one register with them?
It said that there will be 2 weeks, 1 week for 19-year-olds and 1 week for 20-year-olds. There must be some extension on that. I can't believe that.
And to your local post office, so wherever you are, you travel to some particular post office?
Now, I've read two different things. Before registration was passed on the 12th, I heard from Barry Lynn, who is the national director of CARD, Committee Against Registration of the Draft, that you would have to go to your local draft board. That means students at Duke University who reside in Durham, North Carolina 9 months of the year would have to go back to Boston, Massachusetts, if that was where their home was. Now it says any post office. That is what U.S. World Report said. Any post office. I don't think Holden is the only post office.
18-year-olds have to register on the list.
18-year-olds will have to begin registering next year on their birthday.
Now, is there, under what conditions wouldn't one register? Is there,
unless you would choose to be non-compliant, you would register. Now, there are a lot of things that go into registering, too. Last year, they were considering doing it through computers. And you wouldn't even get a chance to go in and see the person that was taking down your name or anything. You would not even have that opportunity. A computer, whether you're listed because of your social security number, because of your driver's license, because you're on a computer at your school, that they would have to somehow get around the Privacy Act. The government was trying to get around the Privacy Act at that time and get into all the computers and therefore get a list of people. The only way you can get around that is from, you know, natural childbirth at home, never getting a driver's license, never getting a social security number, never registering at college, or whatever.
So they have gotten around. They've gotten around the Privacy Act.
No, they have not yet gotten around the Privacy Act. That was one thing that was being considered, and it might possibly still be considered. Mary?
I thought it was interesting that a congressman a month ago said he thought all registration should take place at the local gas station so everyone would know why we were doing this at this time.
Who said that?
I think Dylan's.
Okay,
well, that sort of answers what sort of going through mind. Why right now? Why is this happening right now? Is this a show of force? Is this because somebody up there knows something more than we do that's going to happen and they're planning it?
Well,
what's the big... is why.
One senator who happens to be Lutheran, I believe he's Lutheran, from Texas said we have to do it because the president wants it and therefore we cannot embarrass the president. That was a statement that was publicized around the country.
Okay, but why does the president want it?
To save time. Yeah, seven to five days.
Yeah, maybe that's just so much. He said he's using the symbolic gesture. John, symbolic gesture.
This is the part where it's so difficult to get information. You read differences of opinion from military leaders. Very wide differences of opinion. Is the all-volunteer army working or not working? You read a variety of opinions. You read some publications said that the president's own advisors, a month before he spoke in January, said that registration was not needed and that the whole thing would take like seven more days if we didn't register. Then he made his speech in January, his representatives had a tough time in Congress because they had his own advisors a month before disagreeing with what he said in January and confronted the spokesman with it. So is it going to say 90 days or is it going to say 7 days?
It wasn't even a month. It was January 16th that report came out from the Defense Department, and on January 23rd he gave his State of the Union.
7 days. Yeah, it was a strange kind of a mixed message. But the first talk of registration and draft, and that we were not militarily prepared, came out of the Pentagon when they did a scenario. And they speculated on a ground warfare in Middle Europe, and we did not have the potential to fight that. That was what they used as the first talk of reinstating the draft. It had a name, and it speculated how long and how many casualties there would be, and that we were not prepared for this possibility of ground warfare in Middle Europe. That was the first talk in 6 years, was this kind of war game. I don't know what you do with that kind of information. I mean, how do you feed into a computer a war game? So it really is very complicated on getting what's going on.
Before we get on the president's back, I'd like to clarify one thing, and that is when you register, you have the choice not to be in combat, right?
No.
You have no choice?
You have no choice at all when you register. No. She's absolutely right.
Absolutely. You could.
All it is your name, your social security number, your address, your phone. I have a copy of the card.
Okay, but say there is a war. Then do you have a choice whether you want to combat or not? Because if you do have a choice, then I don't see why everybody's so up in arms about, because
the point is you don't have any idea what it would be, because that takes a congressional action to reinstate the draft. The president had the power to begin to register men 18 to 26. What he needed was the appropriation of money to do that. That's what he got. If there's a draft, all you can talk about is what the draft was like last time. The rest is pure speculation as to what the Social Security legislation would be if there was a future draft.
They say that you will have, I have heard that you will have 10 days after you receive your letter that you were drafted to come up with your CO file or to go off to your first base.
The draft this time around, all of those, it's interesting to know how those rules have been changed to allow the system to function more smoothly than it did during the Vietnam era. As far as there's no categories, you just register your name, you have a shorter amount of time. They're making it seems so that the system will run with fewer snags. And they're making it indeed, it seems, so that any person who does object really does not fit into the system at all. They don't even have to worry about it. It's too bad that after Vietnam died down and after the draft was stopped, that there was not a movement in the court to try and make our feelings present. We just kind of blew it. We just sat down because I don't think anyone ever felt that the draft would be reinstated again. That's too bad.
Does anyone have a problem, instead of talking so much in generalities, and I appreciate you bringing it around to the specifics, is there a problem with the registration other than future possibilities?
Of war?
Yeah. No, future possibilities of what might be another act of Congress would draft. Do you have a problem with the specific registration legislation, since that's kind of the topic?
I don't really see how one can try to separate registration from the draft, because registration exists for no other reason than for a future draft. I think the two are, you know, inseparably connected.
Why else do they want your little, your name on this little sheet of paper? You know, they're not going to file it and hold it up.
But the problems I heard expressed were problems with what might be legislated at a future point, you know, how the CO status would be decided, that kind of thing. Is there a problem with just signing up with the possibility of a draft?
Yeah,
but you put the power in their hands. They know where you are.
They know where you are anyway.
Well, you're giving him that information. You're giving it to him.
You're giving away part of your freedom.
If you move anywhere, you have to tell them.
Does anybody sense a feeling of obligation as far as if you were drafted, then to say, then to make a stand and say, hey, I feel it's my duty to participate in a non-combat stand? That's, I have problems with the mood that this discussion's taking. As far as that, you know, is it an either-or kind of thing? And should we bring up our sense of obligations as Americans, too, and not just, you know, worry about killing people?
I think that's an important thing. Our that's what we started talking at the beginning. What are our responsibilities to the government for the benefits that they afford us? Do we owe them anything? Steve?
I think you could take a position different than was said, that registration and the draft really are separate. That I would think registration is a politically controversial thing, whereas the draft is a religiously controversial thing. I still find it hard, even after the excellent description of thou shalt not kill, meaning possibly thou shalt not murder or choose the lesser of two sins, I would think that's still a theological, personal, religious thing at the time when somebody says you've got to shoot somebody. That's different than the political considerations of registering. I think the traditional Quaker position has not been opposed to registration, simply been opposed to participation in the military in any form at all, however you get there.
I guess one real problem that I had when they first came out with this during the late winter, January, and they're talking, at that time, Afghanistan was in the news. I thought of being drafted, and I thought of going to Afghanistan. And there's no way in my mind that I could picture myself going off and fighting in Afghanistan to protect my gasoline supply. But then on the other hand, what always comes to my mind is, what would I do if the United States was attacked? And I really don't know exactly what I do. I have a feeling that I'd probably enlist at that time. But I don't know. I just don't know. I've got those two things that are on my mind. There's no way that I want to go and fight in a foreign country like Afghanistan under those conditions to save my petrol supply.
Linda? I really am glad that I live in the United States, and as a citizen, there's a lot of things I'd like to protect, and I'm going to participate in the Democratic Convention in New York in August as a delegate, and I'm glad to be doing that because I want to be part of the political process. But I think I would like to think of myself as a world citizen before an American citizen. And in my opinion, participation in a war at this time with the nuclear technology that we have would be in violation of my world citizenship. But as an American person in the United States, I hope that I could work for my country in nonviolent ways. And in World War II, maybe somebody could tell the story better, but in Denmark, something happened non-violently. A lot of Jews were there, and a lot of the people from Denmark were there too, and Hitler was going to go in and kill all of the Jews. So those people, instead of trying to fight back with weapons, fought back by putting yellow stars on too, and everyone was saved. So the people from Denmark took a real risk with their lives. They could have been killed too. But at the same time, you know, they won. So maybe that's what we have to do as American people. Try to find all the nonviolent ways that we can.
There was somebody up in the balcony that I missed.
Okay. First of all, I want to say I agree with Linda. I think that she says very well. And I like what she said. Secondly, people back here, I kind of agree with them. It seems that we've been looking a lot at registration and draft and government taking away our freedoms, but we haven't looked at what the government's been giving us. And, you know, it seems when the government's willing to give us something, boy, we're first in line. But when the government asks something of us, government is restricting our freedom. The government is denying us our natural rights. And yet, I think back to John F. Kennedy and in his inauguration speech where he asked not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I think that Americans as a whole have lost that spirit of let's help our neighbor, and instead of bitching about everything, let's go out and do something.
Why do you think we've lost that spirit?
First of all, because I think this is me first generation in many ways. And in fact, the 70s have been kind of called a me first generation. I think everybody's waiting. I think also because from the words said here, everybody speaks of the government as them, and the government's us. And people have forgotten that. And one man over here has talked about we should have elections on wards. Well, we do. Everybody here can vote every 2 years on the representatives. Everybody can write their congressman. I'd like to know how many people here right now have written their congressman in the last 3 months. Raise your hand. I'd say maybe 5% people, maybe 10%. You know, it's pretty hard to get an accurate reflection of what the people in this country feel when you are stuck in Washington and when the people will not correspond with you. I know that many representatives try to conduct surveys through mailing lists, and 10% of the people they write to in their districts will respond. That's really tough to make a very valued judgment on. And those guys have a lot of tough decisions to make. There's a lot of bills going through Congress every day. I worked with congressmen for a while, and I know what went through his mind. And I think that it's time that this country starts to realize that we are the government and decides that the people have the power to work through the system.
I'm just rolling.
Yes, you asked the question before, what do we owe the government? And then there was another point made, you know, why now with this registration? It seems to me that one element that we're looking at right now is the embarrassment of a kind of a national pride where we have been pushed around here and there in the world and haven't seemed to be able, every time we try to do something to right that, it's wrong. And there's been a growing impatience, and I'm sure our leadership feels that keenly. And it seems to me that out of this sense of pride, we are beginning to get a little bit desperate at points. And so you hear other voices saying, hey, wait a minute, let's not rush out in there. Let's cool this and keep our rationality. Seems to me if there's something that all of us as Christians owe the government right now, it's to sound that note, you know, that we're not, let's not be stampeded into confrontations, because we don't like to give up this illusion of being the biggest and strongest in the world. And I do think that that is a part of our climate right now. It's probably not, I'm sure it's not the whole issue, but it's a significant part that we ought to be hearing about.
I'm not very knowledgeable about politics or politicians, but I've heard the statement several times that, you know, after all, we can vote for who we want and what they think, and then, you know, that'll be the way it is. But maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought last time the presidential elections came around, the president who we elected said he was going to decrease defense spending, and it's been increased and increased. So, I think I'm right about that.
Okay.
So people have been asking what kind of hypothetically or what do we owe our country? And I think as Christian people, Christ has been amazingly left out of this conversation. And I think that claiming to be Christians, we claim Jesus as our common Lord. And Lord means Lord of all aspects of our life. We don't get to choose which parts. And I think when we claim to be Christ-like, we are claiming to be part of something, and part of someone, much bigger than ourselves, our nation, or even the globe. And I think for Christian people, our first question has to be, what do I owe my Lord? And that has to come before, what do I owe my country? Because first of all, we're citizens of the kingdom of God. And we happen to be Americans, and somehow we have to be faithful citizens of the kingdom of God with our citizenship to the point where we don't lose or compromise our loyalty to our Lord. And given the current military technology, on that point, I guess I would think of myself and think that as Christian people that we would be nuclear pacifists. Just what war criteria says that given nuclear technology we can't have a just war. But more radically and more straightforward, I think Jesus said it on the Sermon on the Mount. He didn't say form a military to defend yourselves and what you possess. He said you're going to learn how to live and you learn how to die. You're supposed to love your enemies, not curse them. And I don't think he was talking in spiritual, fluffy terms. I think he meant that concretely, and I think his death on a cross proved that out in reality. And I think we really have to struggle first with what does it mean to be Christian, Christ-like? What does it mean to follow after this God-man? And then all the issues of peace, war, and conscience seem to be very integrated and related. But I think if we're going to claim Christian, we have to start with the question, where do we say we begin?
Could I speak to that? Let's say you ask that and the inevitable happens that we get in the war. Then you have to ask the question of how can I be the best witness. And what Bonhoeffer did from the other night, he didn't stay home. He went out and was actively involved in it. And then you ask the question, how can I actively be involved in this cause as a Christian? You see what I mean? If you can't make the decision whether or not to go to war or not, and the decision has been made for you, then you have to ask yourself how you're going to react to that. I was just, you know, trying to be on the practical side if the decision hadn't been made.